So have a wonderful weekend. Bye-bye. It's WORT, Madison.
Hello, this is Julie Candler with the BBC News. The US Secretary of State Antony Blinken has told the BBC the United States is prepared to take steps against China if it continues to supply Russia with items used for its war in Ukraine. Speaking after talks with President Xi Jinping, Mr. Blinken said he had made it clear that China was helping to fuel the biggest threat to European security since the end of the Cold War. Here's Laura Bicker.
America might believe they're coming to this from a position of strength, that they're issuing this threat from a position of strength because Beijing at this time does not want more sanctions as it's trying to prop up an ailing economy. It wants more American business, not less. So America might feel that it's in a position to put this threat out there at this time, but China will not react well to it. Already they're pushing back and it risks derailing an already fragile relationship.
Two hospitals in Kiev are being urgently evacuated after Russia's ally Belarus claimed the Ukrainian military was using sick children there as human shields. With more details, here's Sasha Schlichter.
Russia often relies on a smaller ally to make the more outlandish and bizarre claims about Ukraine. In a clip, the head of Belarus's security service states bluntly that what he calls Ukrainian militants have set up quarters in two adjacent Kiev hospitals, one of them a children's clinic. He said militants were undergoing training for an armed invasion of Belarus. The Kiev authorities described the claim as an absolute lie and provocation. They said targeting hospitals was part of Russia's strategy of striking the social infrastructure of the capital.
A UN official has said the huge amount of rubble, including unexploded ammunition, left by Israel's war against Hamas in Gaza, could take 14 years to remove. Per Lodhammer from UN Mine Action Service said around 37 million tons of debris would need to be cleared. King Charles is to return to royal duties after reacting positively to treatment for cancer. A Buckingham Palace spokesman said doctors remain positive about his recovery. More from Johnny Diamond.
This does not mark the end of the King's treatment for cancer. On that, Buckingham Palace is clear. But just over 11 weeks since the King's diagnosis and the start of his cancer treatment, the palace says the King's doctors are sufficiently pleased with his progress so far that he'll now resume a number of public-facing duties. He's carried out his state duties, audiences with the Prime Minister and the like, throughout. The King is said to be greatly encouraged to be resuming his duties and very grateful to his medical team.
World News from the BBC. The authorities in Kenya say the number of people killed in severe flooding there has risen to 70. Kenya and other countries in East Africa have seen heavier than usual rainfall in recent weeks, exacerbated by the El Niño weather pattern. The instant messaging platform WhatsApp has threatened to leave India if it's forced to break its message encryption. A lawyer for the company told a court in Delhi that WhatsApp's end-to-end encryption protects users' privacy. The company gave its response while challenging the Indian authorities' demand to be able to trace chats and identify the first originators of information. The government argues that it needs to do so to contain fake news and inflammatory content. The Brazilian football star Marta has announced that she will retire from international football later this year. Announcing the news in a TV interview, the 38-year-old said she was comfortable passing the baton to Brazil's next generation of footballers. John Bennett reports.
Marta will be hoping to end her international career on a high with a sixth appearance at the Olympic Games later this year. But she's confirmed that whether or not she's selected for the Brazil squad, this will be her final year in international football. The 38-year-old is the all-time leading goal scorer in World Cup history, scoring 17 times in 23 appearances. She won Olympic silver in Athens in 2004 and Beijing 2008 and helped Brazil to reach the World Cup final in 2007.
China says it will cooperate with the World Anti-Doping Agency and allow its domestic anti-doping agency to undergo an audit. The announcement follows confirmation from WADA and China this week that 23 top Chinese swimmers tested positive for a performance-enhancing drug in 2021, but were secretly allowed to continue competing. Several of the swimmers went on to win medals at the Tokyo Olympics, including gold. BBC News.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Just Coffee, Madison's Fair Trade Roasting Cooperative. Just Coffee buys fair trade coffee to ensure equitable conditions for coffee grower cooperatives around the world and roasts locally in small batches. More information at 204-9011 or on the web at justcoffee.coop.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Five Nines, a locally owned cloud service provider of enterprise-level IT infrastructure consulting, hosting, and management services. On the web at 59s.com. Phone number 512-1000.
6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground.
No change without struggle. No one in power ain't giving up nothing. No change without struggle. No one in power.
WORT 89.9 FM, listener-sponsored community radio, Madison, Wisconsin.
And hello, welcome to A Public Affair. I am STD Noor. In a couple of minutes, we will be talking with Jacob Kushner, the author of a new book titled Look Away, a true story of murders, bombings, and a far-right campaign to rid Germany of immigrants. But before, we did get a message from our representative on the Gaza Freedom Flotilla, Cassandra Dixon, and we want to listen to that.
Hi, my name's Cassandra Dixon, and I live in Madison, Wisconsin. I'm asking you to call the State Department and ask that they allow the Gaza Freedom Flotilla to sail. Right now, the U.S. is blocking Turkey from allowing these boats to leave Istanbul. These boats are part of a civilian initiative to bring aid to Gaza and to break the blockade. Among the items that Israel prevents from entering Gaza are animal feed, oxygen, crutches, solar panels, solar lights, stone fruits, tent poles, ultrasound equipment, water pumps, and wheelchairs. The Gaza Freedom Flotilla is attempting to leave Istanbul with 5,500 tons of desperately needed humanitarian aid, headed straight to Gaza, where people are starving right now due to Israel's failure to allow in aid. The State Department number in the U.S. is 888-407-4747. And I urge you to call both them and your elected representatives and ask that they demand that the U.S. State Department stop blocking Turkey from allowing these boats to sail. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
And just to add to that, as of this time, the official death toll in Gaza is 40,000, most of them children and women. As you probably know, 300 bodies were found in mass graves next to Nasser Hospital in Gaza. More were found in a mass grave outside Shifa Hospital. The situation is absolutely desperate. So I hope you do what Cassandra is asking us, the State Department, Baldwin, Johnson, and Pocan, if you can call all of them and ask them to do what they can to make it possible for the flotilla to sail to Gaza. They have about 5,500 tons of various things, and That's about the worth of 100 trucks. So we are going back to our topic today. Jacob Kushner is a foreign correspondent who writes magazine and other long-form articles from Africa, Germany, and the Caribbean. His writing has appeared in dozens of publications, including the New York Times, The Atlantic, The New Yorker, Harper's, The Economist, National Geographic, The Atavist, The Nation, Foreign Policy, and The Guardian. He is the author of China's Congo Plan, which was favorably reviewed in the New York Review of Books. A Fulbright Germany scholar and Logan Nonfiction Fellow, he was a finalist for the Livingston Award in International Reporting. He teaches and advises ambitious young journalists at the Pulitzer Center, the Overseas Press Club, and several universities. Hello, Jacob. Thank you for joining us again. It's good to see you.
Hi, thanks so much for having me back.
And you are in Nairobi, as you were last time we talked, which is several years ago. What are you doing in Nairobi?
Absolutely. Well, there's a lot going on in Kenya right now, as your listeners heard from that BBC broadcast just a few minutes ago. There's been incredible rainfall recently, which has caused terrible flooding here in Nairobi, where I live. At least 70 people have already been killed, and so many more thousands displaced by flooding. So that's going on now. But as a journalist, I've actually been based out here in Nairobi for quite some years now, reporting on everything from China, Chinese investment in Africa, and infrastructure here, as you mentioned that previous book, to investigating police brutality and other sorts of kind of abuses of power by Kenya's government, sometimes in the name of fighting terrorism, taking a play from the U.S. playbook there, kind of targeting and sometimes even rounding up Muslims as an excuse for fighting terrorism, that sort of thing. So yeah, lots of investigations into kind of government misconduct here. And then above all, I report a lot on refugees. So I spent some years on a previous book project reporting on LGBTQ refugees across East Africa. So those are some of the things I report on here.
Yeah, and maybe we'll get to talk towards the end about China's Congo plan. That's also interesting. Let me ask you a question just out of the blue that has nothing to do with our show today, but I used to be the artistic director of the Madison World Music Festival. And as such, I was asked one year by a small department in the State Department that actually does good. They make connections with several countries every year to bring artists from them, and at a reduced price for presenters. And I was asked to listen to the artists and make recommendations. And one of the countries at that time was Kenya. And I swear 90% or even more of the artists sent music about Jesus. And I was like, wow, from Kenya? Is Kenya a really Christian country?
Actually, it very much is. I just wrote an article about this that I think appeared a few days ago for The Dial magazine. So Kenya is predominantly Christian, and there's different Christian faiths here. There's a minority of Muslim faith. I forget if what the percent of Islam is here, but it's probably closer to 20%, I believe. But, you know, I actually just wrote a story about Pentecostalism because there's this rising radicalization, not just of Islamic extremism here in Kenya, which gets more attention, but actually Christian nationalism and Christian extremism. So there was a huge incident that happened here about a year ago in which it turned out that a Pentecostal pastor convinced his congregation to retreat with him into a forest and actually starve themselves and their children to death. And something like 430 people ended up starving to death because of this sort of Pentecostal cult. And so I actually just did a Q&A with an expert here in Kenya on religion about that incident and kind of, you know, Pentecostalism and its rise here in Kenya. So, you know, there's, you know, he was kind of comparing that pastor's of radicalization to the sort of radicalization you see by Islamist extremist groups in the same region.
Yeah, I heard about that. And yeah. Okay, well, very interesting. Let's get to your book, though. Look Away, A True Story of Murders, Bombings, and a Far-Right Campaign to Rid Germany of Immigrants. How did you come to write this book?
Well, yeah, speaking of radicalization and extremism, yeah. I guess it's the same topic. I was led to it from Kenya. So I was reporting that book on and stories on LGBT refugees in Kenya. And there's just a lot of violence and attacks against those people here. And then come 2015, the global refugee crisis and the mass arrival of refugees to Europe. And I started hearing about violence in Germany against refugees. And I thought, well, you know, I've been reporting on this here in East Africa. But it turns out, these aren't the only parts of the world where there's xenophobic violence against refugees. So I started traveling to Germany to investigate those attacks and ended up doing a series of stories for Al Jazeera and some other outlets about far-right violence. You know, Germans often were burning down refugee shelters in Germany in 2015-16 especially, usually before the refugees would arrive. So if you are a xenophobic German and you don't want refugees coming to your town, you might go and try to burn down the building where they're supposed to come and be sheltered so they can't come to your town. And so there was a lot of that. But there were actually also attacks on refugees themselves, physical assaults and whatnot, even sort of mini bombings and those sorts of things. So I started investigating those, and it was during that time that I actually heard about this terrible earlier case called the NSU. And this was a German terrorist organization that operated in the 2000s, from 1999 actually to 2011. And they went around Germany for all of those years murdering immigrants in different cities, assassinating them, and bombing neighborhoods where immigrants lived. And so that kind of, startled me, and I diverted and started covering the trial and that case, and that led to this book out years later, yes.
Mm-hmm. So just curious, has the book been translated to German, or is it being translated?
Not yet. We're looking for a German publisher who would be willing to translate it. So I hope to have some good news about that soon.
Uh-huh. So set up the context for us. What happened in the early 2000s to make what your story is about happen? What happened in 2015-16? Why did all this anti-immigrant hatred and violence happen?
Absolutely. Well, to understand that, we actually have to go back a little bit further to like the 1990s and, the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989 and kind of reunification that happened after that. So, there was a lot of turmoil in East Germany after the Berlin Wall fell because a lot of companies were bought out by their Western counterparts. There was high unemployment and that sort of thing. Often the way the story goes is that sort of resentment and unemployment led to xenophobia and sort of hatred toward immigrants by some people in the East. There is research to support that, but that isn't true for everyone. And that's not really directly the case for the characters in my book who would become the terrorists who formed the NSU. Because in this case, there were three friends growing up in the East German town of Jena. This is a town just a couple hours from Berlin, a kind of university town with famous philosophers who used to study there and do research there dating back hundreds of years, Jena. And so, but in the 1990s, these three teenagers, one named Beata Cepa and two who shared the same first name, Uwe, they became friends in the early 1990s. And, they started to blame immigrants for all sorts of things, but for taking jobs, for just kind of overall really anything. But if you look at these people's lives, one of them, Uwe Munlos, was the son of a professor. He himself was incredibly smart. He ended up going to university. I mean, he had jobs. He never lacked for opportunities. And Beata Cepa, the woman of the group, she also did apprenticeships, internships, that sort of thing, and had stints with jobs and ended up, not working a lot by choice, most likely. And then Bernhard, sort of brash-headed, kind of real fighter of the group. He very much chose not to work and chose to, a life of crime instead. So, I think it's important to note that while for many people did struggle in the former East in the 1990s with unemployment and other sorts of things, these particular characters who had become far-right extremists and blame immigrants, they did not, for the most part, struggle the way others did.
Mm, yeah, that's very interesting. I came to the station from a conference that's happening right now at the UW. It's titled Lessons from the Revolutions of 1989 in East Central Europe. And at least one of the speakers said something that I have thought about before, and I'm curious about your thinking. A lot of the neo-Nazism, a lot of the far-right extremism came, and I think still comes from the East, what used to be Eastern Germany, i.e. under so-called communist rule. And as I mentioned, one of the speakers said that even the revolutions that seem to have succeeded, in a sense, didn't, because of the response, which basically is far right extremism. Is that part of it, or why do you think so much came from Eastern Germany once it has been reunited with Western Germany?
Yeah, well, first of all, it's important to note that actually Western Germany had its own, you know, enormous share of far-right extremists as well. So this wasn't, you know, unique to Eastern Germany. But, you know, I think there's one difference is that, you know, in the East during the GDR, you know, post-World War II up to the fall of the Berlin Wall, you know, East Germans, my understanding is what they learned in schools, what they learned in history books was that East Germans were not Nazis, right? And so, you know, rather than, you know, some forms of reckoning with, you know, what Germans did, you know, in the Nazi party and that far right, you know, Holocaust and genocide, instead they didn't, you know, they learned that that was done by the West. And so whereas, you know, and again, to be fair, in the West, you know, Germany has always been, for decades, has been slow to teach and kind of recognize until this movement in the 1960s to kind of recognize, you know, and reckon with what they did. But in East Germany, that never happened at all, you know. And so I think, you know, by reunification, it was just the situation, you know, where a lot of East Germans just weren't that familiar with their own history in the recent decades of what their parents and grandparents had done when it came to far-right extremism.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's interesting. So tell us about the Rostock riots, also by way of background here.
Absolutely. So that this is an early chapter in the book. We see this event that plays out in 1992 in Rostock in North Germany. Basically, this is just, you know, shortly after reunification, and there was this building in Rostock where lots of immigrants were living, immigrants from Vietnam, also Romani and Sinti people who, some of which, you know, some of whom had lived in Germany forever, but some of whom had migrated from Eastern Europe. And basically, this over the course of a couple days, huge mobs of far-right Germans descended from all over the region to this building to protest outside this building and ended up lobbing Molotov cocktails at the building, eventually setting it on fire. It was basically these 3 days of out-of-control protests and riots that police and firefighters were unable to stop while frightened immigrants kind of feared for their lives inside this building. Eventually, it finally ended when a social worker was able to help lead some of those refugees kind of up to the roof and down a back staircase to safety, and police were eventually able to, you know, help them get out after 3 days. But, you know, the Rostock riots were this moment when xenophobia in Germany kind of took the center stage, and that those attacks led to lots of copycat attacks throughout the nation. And I argue in my book that's partly because prosecutors didn't really take the attacks seriously. Prosecutors actually charged more counter-protesters who were trying to defend the immigrants and march through Rostock than they charged the neo-Nazis themselves. So I think that signaled to neo-Nazis around Germany that violence against immigrants would not be taken seriously. And as a result, I think in the coming years, there were more attacks against immigrants in Germany. Arsons, you know, entire families burned alive by far-right extremists in Solingen and Mulm and these different German towns and cities. So Rostock is kind of remembered as one of the moments where this far-right violence really resurged in the early 1990s.
Mm-hmm. And our three terrorists that you write about in the book, well, obviously you just said that far-right extremism was a fairly widespread ideology, and obviously more than that. But tell us about the National Socialist Underground and its effects on the three.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So, you know, these three, it wasn't just these three, but these three were the, basically what happened is they, throughout the 1990s, the late 1990s, they started acting upon their xenophobia. So for example, they would leave threatening letters for Jewish politicians. They would leave fake, and they started leaving fake bombs all around Jena, their hometown, as sort of a threat, you know, to Jews, Jewish leaders, to immigrants, that sort of thing. And so they, you know, maybe they viewed them as stunts, but these things got more and more serious to the point that, you know, actually, and there were police officers trying to, put a stop to this and figuring out who was doing it, right? But actually, what was going on during the 1990s is Germany's intelligence agency was protecting the sort of radical ringleader who helped radicalize these three friends. His name was Tino Brandt, and he was actually an intelligence agent, undercover, an informant. And so basically, you know, while he's radicalizing them, he's getting paid taxpayer money from the German state. He's investing that money into the far right scene, and he's not really ratting out any of his friends for their crimes and the sorts of things he's orchestrating. And so he was getting all this protection from the German intelligence agencies. And it's important to remember that, you know, Germany is probably has some of the most infamous intelligence agencies in the world. The Gestapo, you know, during the 1930s and 40s, were the, you know, the secret police of the Nazis who, you know, relied on informants to rat out Jews all across, you know, Germany. And then you had the Stasi, of course, one of the largest informant apparatuses in history under East Germany. And so I think there were some relics of these sort of agencies with their vast reliance on informants, even after the Berlin Wall fell and even after Germany reunited. These intelligence agencies still had this huge reliance on informants and often nefarious ones like this Tino Brandt. So anyways, he's an important character in the book because it was sort of the ideological force behind these three before they became terrorists, at least. And so what ended up happening is finally in 1998, the police raid a garage in Jena and discover all these bomb making materials in it. And and they're also searching the garages and houses of these three friends. But while they're doing that, the friends actually escape. One of the friends was at home and police let him go. The other two had not been at home. They reunited and they escaped in January 1998 into the underground. And then it was from that point that they started plotting their actual terrorist attacks against immigrants that they would carry out for the next 13 years.
Mm-hmm. My guest is Jacob Kushner. He's a foreign correspondent. He writes magazine and long-form articles. And we are talking about his pretty much just released book, Look Away, A True Story of Murders, Bombings, and a Far-Right Campaign to Rid Germany of Immigrants. We are getting into the meat of the book, but if you want to join, our number is 608-256-2001, extension 9, right? Okay, someone will let me know right away. And you can also join us on social media at WarTalk on X or A Public Affair on Facebook, and no extension needed, 608-256-2001. So before we get to what they did, why immigrants? What messages did they hear from whom, and how truthful are these messages?
Absolutely. I mean, in a sense, I think that to far-right extremists in Germany, immigrants became and remain today the new Jews, in a sense. There weren't many Jews left in Germany, although some Jews did move back after the Holocaust, including a famous Jewish leader named Ignaz Bubist, who lived in Thuringen, the state where these terrorists were from. He was actually someone they really hated, and they would send threatening letters to him and whatnot. I think naturally you're looking for, when you're looking for someone, a scapegoat, immigrants were, you know, there. They became more visible after the wall fell. I mean, before, there were immigrants in both sides sides of Germany before the wall fell. But after it fell, you know, these immigrants were no longer just living in like the dockyards and dormitories and dockyards and shipyards and factories and that sort of thing. They started, you know, moving to cities and towns and opening businesses and that sort of thing. So they became a bit more visible. I think that's what drew them to immigrants. But also, you know, these folks were reading, you know, Nazi ideology, and they, you know, then they basically kind of adopted a lot of old, you know, hate against people of different races. And so, you know, I think it's that combination of immigrants becoming more visible and sort of their indoctrination into, you know, standard, you know, historic German far-right ideology as well. And so, yeah, immigrants started catching their eye, and they started writing, they started keeping this manifesto, actually, this video manifesto, as they started committing their attacks, where they would record television news footage of police and journalists responding to these attacks. And they ended up, over the decade or over the 12 years, creating this sort of horrible video, a cartoon where they set it to the Pink Panther cartoon, and then they would cut from like this sort of cartoon panther to the bodies of these immigrants. And basically, in this manifesto that they would eventually release, they were claiming that we are protecting our nation of immigrants. That is what the National Socialist Underground, the NSU, their terrorist group, stands for, protecting and trying to rid Germany of immigrants. So that just became kind of their main motive.
Mm-hmm. So what were the crimes that they committed, and how?
Absolutely. So first of all, living on the run, they needed to fund their terrorism. They needed to afford apartments. And they did rely on lots of far-right friends in the cities where they hid out, to put them up, to rent apartments for them, rent them cars, that sort of thing. But then they also found a new lucrative way to make money, which was robbing banks. And so they actually robbed 15 banks over the course of their time on the run. And this is, you know, mostly in the 2000s. So it's kind of recent history. They developed a way of robbing banks where they would rent a RV, a camper van, they would drive it to the near, you know, maybe a mile or two from where they were going to rob the bank. And then they would take out bicycles, and they would cycle to the bank, rob the bank, and cycle back to the van, hide the bikes in the van, and wait out for a day or two or three until police stopped looking for them. It was kind of this clever way of doing it, because, you know, police had set up roadblocks and whatnot and track license plates after all these bank attacks. Anyways, they were robbing these banks and earned lots and lots of money from doing that. And that allowed them to buy weapons, it allowed them to buy explosive materials, it allowed them to pay their rent and you know, travel and all the things they'd like to do. They would take summer vacations in the north of Germany, not far from Rostock, actually, where those riots took place. So first there was the bank robbing, that's how they made money. But then as far as their actual attacks, they would, you know, do something similar. They would go, for example, they twice bombed an immigrant, two different immigrant neighborhoods in Cologne. So similarly, I guess the first time they walked into an Iranian-owned grocery store in Cologne, and they left a box. Like they were carrying, one of the guys was carrying around a basket with some, you know, normal-looking food items, but there was a bomb buried beneath. He left the basket there, said, "Oh, I forgot my wallet. I'm going to go home." The shop owners put the basket in the back of the store. It actually stayed there for a month, and then finally, the daughter of I think 19-year-old daughter of the shop owners opened it, and it exploded and injured her terribly, and caused this like permanent damage to her face. That was the first bombing, but it didn't go how they wanted because it only hurt one person. So they actually returned to the same city years later and created a bicycle bomb, a nail bomb. And so basically they wheeled a bicycle with this massive bomb in the back, leaned it against a barbershop window on the street lined with immigrant businesses in the center of Cologne, and remotely detonated it. And again, were able to escape by cycling back to their camper van and then driving away. And so, you know, those were some, a couple of the bombings. As far as the murders, the assassinations, they wouldn't really, you know, again, there's a lot of debate over this. A lot of families of the victims, you know, want to know why their dad, their husband, their son was targeted and to be killed. But as far as we know, it seems as if they would just go to a city, kind of look around for a kebab shop, an immigrant-owned business, a restaurant, a grocery store, something like that, and just go in and, you know, wait till the coast was relatively clear, go in, shoot the person, leave, and again, cycle away without getting caught. And so that was kind of, you know, this bicycle modus operandi was kind of how they got away with most of this. I mean, they had a couple close calls, but they were never caught while committing their crimes.
Mm-hmm. So about robbing banks, which, as you said, financed what they were doing. But I wonder, since, you know, most people hate banks and, you know, people who are very rich, I'm thinking about the Robin Hood effect. Did that bring them sympathy from people who maybe otherwise wouldn't have liked what they were doing?
Interesting. You know, actually, I should clarify that. Nobody knew. I mean, Germany did not know that this was going on because the NSU did not announce themselves until after they fell apart in 2011. So this whole time, if you're watching the news in your local town, you might have heard that a bank was robbed. You know, maybe there might have even been a couple stories that, oh, there's been a series of bank robberies in Saxony or something. But here's the thing. These were not connected because the NSU was not claiming much credit for themselves. Now, they did a couple times. They did write, for example, to a far-right news magazine and say, we are the NSU and we are this. I mean, they didn't say who they are, but they said the NSU stands for this and this and that, which was insane because, you know, the intelligence agencies should be monitoring these news outlets. And, you know, there's no record that they were investigating the NSU. So there was, you know, once at least where the NSU sort of did announce themselves publicly, but that was in a small far-right newsletter that was, you know, illegal and that not many people read, right? So this whole time, no one really knows who's committing these attacks. No one necessarily knows that they're all connected. Now that begins to change because of what the families of the immigrant families did themselves. So once the murders started taking place, the immigrant families ended up, they were able to connect the dots. You know, police, every time, basically, this is what happened every time there was a murder. In most cases, a Turkish immigrant would be murdered. Police would respond and immediately they would start suspecting the family. They would start questioning the family. Are you guys involved in drugs? Are you involved in Kurdish, Turkish politics? Is there, you know, immediately police just saw this as organized crime and they saw immigrants as the ones to blame. And so these families were traumatized. Police would even accuse the families themselves of orchestrating the hit for some reason. They would show the wives of these murdered men images of, you know, blonde German women saying, hey, we have information that your husband was traveling to this other city to sleep with this woman. Can you tell us more about that? And it was just totally made up. The police would just lie to these families and traumatize them. And so these families, for lack of any option, because there no serious justice was being pursued, a couple of members of these families actually banded together to start demanding a serious investigation and trying to say, hey, we are being targeted because we are Turkish, because we are immigrants, and this needs to be investigated seriously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so explain why the police kept blaming the victims.
Absolutely. I mean, it's racial profiling, right? I mean, I think if you were to defend the police, you might try to argue that the police, this didn't look like terrorism that the police knew, right? I mean, Germany had a history of left-wing extremist terrorism with this famous RAF, the Baader-Meinhof group, which has actually been in the news recently because a member of the group was actually just captured after 30 years on the run just a few weeks ago. You know, it didn't look like terrorism because no one was claiming credit for these acts. So, you know, that's the sort of argument that would be later made about the authorities. Authorities would say, you know, there was drug crime. There were immigrants who, deal drugs. And so they would say, so I guess in the positive light, they would say, you know, we were racial profiling, sort of the best way to put it. But, you know, I think what the problem with that is, one of the many problems with that is that at some point, you know, when you're investigating these murders over months and months and months, when you don't have any evidence that there's no drugs, I mean, they would ransack the families, homes, cars, businesses, looking for drugs. I mean, nothing turned up. You know, at some point, you have to move away from your biases and your instincts and start following the actual facts. Facts like the fact that witnesses saw men riding away on bicycles, and these other sorts of clues that did exist that the police didn't really take that seriously. So, I think racial bias is the answer. And, you know, once the truth started coming to light in 2011, once this all the NSU kind of revealed itself, that this has been a huge conversation in Germany ever since. Are our institutions institutionally racist? I mean, is there racism in them, or was this just a tragic mistake? And that's kind of been a conversation in Germany ever since.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we'll get to how they found out, but is it your sense that they really should have made the connection between all of these murders and that they didn't, simply because, as you said, racist ideology?
Yeah, I mean, exactly right. I mean, the question is, you know, who is going to protect, you know, immigrants today? And again, this all happened before the 2014, 15, 16, you know, arrival of many, many asylum seekers to Germany from wars in, you know, Syria, Afghanistan, elsewhere, right? And so the question, and so in that time was, you know, if our police cannot even protect the immigrants who are already here, how are they going to now protect all of these asylum seekers who are coming? And that's sort of the time that I became involved in Germany and started reporting, as I mentioned, in 2015. And sure enough, many, many immigrants were attacked by Germans at that time. So, you know, again, I think to people who, I think to a lot of people I spoke with about this book, about this case in Germany, you know, there have always been these strains of racism, of anti-immigrant sentiment in Germany, as in the United States. There have always been these groups, but it's just really, you know, since the 1990s that a lot of it has just come more to the surface in the form, in some cases, of even these terrorist groups like the NSU.
Mm-hmm. So tell us more about the activism of the families of the victims. What did they do? How did they do? And what effect did that have?
Absolutely. So for my book, I was able to speak at length with Gamze Kubisik. So she is the daughter of Mehmet Kubisik. They're a Kurdish family that immigrated from Turkey to Germany, fleeing violence in their hometown and their home region between the PKK and the Turkish government. And they arrived in Germany. They eventually got citizenship, and they had a wonderful life. I mean, Gamze, you know, recalls to me in her interviews just growing up in a diverse neighborhood with Italian neighbors and, you know, really neighbors from all over the world. And actually, Samia Simsek, another person with a sort of similar story, a Turkish family that moved over from Turkey to Germany. She actually recounts in her own memoir, A Painful Homeland, about, you know, a similar, very kind of idyllic childhood. But you know, speaking with these families, these two women, I mentioned them because they actually were two of the people who most connected after these murders. So Samia's father was the first to be killed, murdered in 2000, Enver Simsek, in a flower stand. He was a flower seller, and he was murdered just on the side of the road by the NSU. And years later, in 2006, as these murders are still going on, Gamze's father is killed in Dortmund, and it's by this time, you know, the even the German media were starting to say, oh, there's a series of murders. Although the media were terrible, they were calling it the kebab murders. Essentially, the media were framing it as, oh, this is immigrant crime as well, just like the police were. So at this time, after Gamze's father is killed, just a few days later, another man is killed in another town. And that family, the Yozgat family, decides to organize a protest, a rally. And so they call Gamze and her mother Elif and ask, do you want to come? They do. Samia and her family come. A few of these different families come together to protest and march. And it's this moment where Gamze meets Samia, and Samia says to her, you have to read the book to kind of think about that moment. But there's this moment where the two of them, you know, realize that they can have power and maybe stop this series of murders if they team up.
Yeah. So how did that string of murders end? It's quite a, like, cinematic end. What was it?
Absolutely. And readers of the book can, you know, kind of get the whole story. But essentially what happens is these bank robbers, who are also terrorists, they finally get caught on their 15th bank robbery. And it's kind of a sensational sort of end. But essentially they are caught and they do something drastic to avoid being caught by the police, you know, as they're being chased by the police. And then meanwhile, their accomplice, Beata, the woman, she's back in their hideout in an apartment, and she's listening to the radio and hears that her accomplices have finally been caught after all these years, and she decides to go on the run. So she actually burns down their hideout, lights it on fire, pours gasoline around it, lights it on fire, and goes on the run and tries to escape. So that is kind of this dramatic moment where things start to fall down, and I think I'll probably leave it to readers to pick up the book and figure out what happens from there.
Yeah. We do want people to read the book. It's a very well-written book. your pose is very what shall I say? You know, it's easy to read. It's very interesting, and you talk, of course, about important things. So we talked until now about the far right. There's also a role in the book for Antifa, and there is again another woman, Katharina Koenig, I suppose, who exposed the NSU network. What can you tell us about that?
Absolutely. So another character, as you mentioned, that readers meet in the book is Katharina Kunisch. So she, her father is actually a leftist activist who was involved in the protests that sort of arguably led to the fall of the Berlin Wall, some of these protests against the GDR government. They move as a family to Jena. And so Katharina is a teenager growing up with in the same town as these terrorists. And again, they're not terrorists yet. They're just teenagers, you know, punks, hoodlums committing petty crimes at first and that sort of thing. But she knew them because basically she joined and kind of began leading a sort of Antifa network started by her father out of a church. He was a pastor out of that church in which they were like monitoring the far-right extremists in their hometown. So again, these are teenagers, people in their 20s who are going around at night, you know, looking at license plates, who are going to these known far-right hideouts, you know, kind of tracking these far-right extremists, you know, keeping records, keeping documents, trying to alert the police about what they're up to, far-right protests and that sort of thing. And so, you know, at one point, Katharina's best friend is actually beat up by this future terrorist, Beata Chepa. This is a small enough town, it's a small enough world, and it's sort of a world inundated with, you know, Antifa and neo-Nazis, and Katharina was the latter. Now, you know, fast forward many years later, you know, all during the 2000s, Katharina was a leftist activist. She joined Germany's leftist party, became a politician, but she, you know, she, like anyone else, didn't know that this was going on, right? So it was really only after the NSU came to light in 2011 and that sort of dramatic incident that that we referenced, that she is like, oh, wait, I know these people. And she and her Antifa network are the ones who start revealing to journalists, hey, it's not just three. Let me tell you about these people who helped them. Let me tell you about who their friends were. Let's investigate. And so basically, they helped expose not the three main terrorists, but a lot of the other people who helped them, who some of whom would eventually be charged and put on trial, a trial that lasted 5 years, an incredibly long trial of some of the people who were participating indirectly in the terrorism and that sort of thing. So she became a really important, I mean, today, to this day, she's, you know, one of Germany's kind of leading sort of voices against the far right. But she also, because she was from their, the hometown of these terrorists, was able to help expose the whole network of the NSU.
Mm-hmm. Why did the trial take so long?
Oh, so many reasons. First of all, there were multiple defendants. So Beata Chepa, the woman, the accomplice, she was put on trial along with four different accomplices. So there was all these different people. They're entitled to different lawyers. Also, Germany has this interesting situation in which the victims, the immigrant families, they were entitled to lawyers as well to represent their interests at the trial. So there were actually 60 lawyers representing the 9 immigrant families of the murdered men, as well as the victims of the bombings and that sort of thing. So, you know, I mean, there's just a whole lot of players at trial. I mean, this courtroom was packed with the press. I mean, there were 50 seats for the press. They were filled almost every day at the high points of the trial. I mean, it was just, you know, a sensational news event in Germany. And there was just a lot of evidence. I mean, the whole nation was paying attention to it. Lots was coming out. There was a lot of evidence that the courts excluded, though, that these families wanted to show how the state was responsible, how police, messed up, how intelligence agencies didn't stop this, how police didn't. But unfortunately for the families, the judges tried to keep the trial narrowly focused on the guilt of those defendants, right? Those actual, you know, people who were in the network. And so there was a lot of back and forthing about that. But in fact, the trial might have even been longer had the immigrant families gotten a little bit more of what they wanted out of it.
So, do you attribute that to the embedded racism in German society or why?
I don't, you know, I had the, that's a good question. I had the benefit of being a, doing a residency at a couple of different law institutes with the Max Planck Society in Germany. And so I was at these different law institutes doing my research, and the conversations with these folks was incredible, because I had conversations with a lot of German legal scholars who say, you know, the problem is really that our courts are not set up for this, right? A criminal trial that's supposed to determine the guilt or innocence of a defendant is not set up to put the state on trial and put these and question what the police did wrong and question, you know, that's not, that was beyond the scope of the German justice system. At least these scholars argue, and that may not be what the families want to hear, but I think that speaks to the need for alternative forms of justice. And actually these families, because they weren't getting the sort of justice they wanted from the trial, they formed a tribunal of their own, like a private thing. And they kind of put together this report of 100-something people they accuse of being somehow responsible for negligence, right? And failing to stop this. And you know, they kind of held a sort of a mock tribunal of their own and did lots of other things. And so, you know, I think it really speaks to the fact that, you know, if what families want is closure, if they want answers, if they want to see how the state is responsible, and if families want to keep this sort of thing from happening again, a traditional criminal trial like the type we have in Germany and in the United States and in many Western nations isn't necessarily going to satisfy that.
Mm-hmm. Well, kudos to the families. We have less than 10 minutes left, so I want to kind of go into the maybe eagle eye view and look at it in a more really societal and universal maybe look. So throughout Western countries, it seems like we are taught to, and we are afraid of Islamists and the kind of radicalizations they go through. But for some reason, Nazis, neo-Nazis, other kinds of extreme right-wingers don't seem as scary. Why is that?
That's an interesting question. You know, I mean, the thing I can speak to in Germany and in the United States is that both governments have known for a very long time who their extremists are. You know, just to kind of, you know, shift to the U.S. for a minute. Shortly after the 9/11 attacks, the FBI actually reminded Congress that far-right extremists, not Islamist extremists, pose America's greatest threat. And that was immediately after those attacks. The FBI even mentioned a couple of threats that were thwarted by the far-right in 1999, just shortly before 9/11, right? And so, you know, and fast forward, you know, the past 25 years, I mean, there's been, you know, there's plenty of data on, you know, the extremist threat. And so that is a really good question. You know, why not? I mean, I think the answers are largely political. We're seeing it sort of today. There was a real spike in far-right attacks in the United States since 2015, since Donald Trump started running for office through 2017. You know, I think there's a bill that's been kind of, you know, introduced every year to Congress that would a domestic terrorism bill that would you know, kind of allow more funding to go to monitoring all sorts of domestic extremism, including far right extremism. But year after year, it dies because there's no Republican support for it. And so you know, it's I think it's a political choice to kind of ignore it. You know, in Germany, this is so common. There's actually a name for this. It's called there's a German saying that police or authorities are blind in the right eye, that they're not seeing the things on that side of the face. They're not seeing the far right. They're kind of looking the other way or not taking it seriously enough and that sort of thing. And, you know, it's certainly an accusation made by those on the left all of the time in Germany. But, you know, it's an accusation bolstered by this, you know, terrorism such as the NSU's.
Yeah. And I think we see it in a very tragic way right now. We started with Gaza. Let's go back there for a moment. Where we just heard on the BBC how the attack on a hospital in Kyiv was denounced by, I think, by Biden or one of his folks. But the fact that Israel has destroyed every hospital in Gaza doesn't stop the United States from giving it another $26 billion for more armaments. And of course, there's a lot of people who are waking up to that. And we're seeing right now the students movement becoming really large and very strong. But generally speaking, it doesn't seem like most Americans care very much, because I'm thinking because they are Muslims, they are Palestinians, and who cares about people who are not white? I might be overstating it, but what's your opinion here?
Well, it's interesting. You know, the way that I kind of this whole situation interacts with my research is really back in Germany. So I don't know if readers, you know, or excuse me, listeners in Wisconsin, you know what's going on in Germany. But ever since October 7th and Israel's response, there have been, you know, protests in Germany to try to stop the German government from giving military support to Israel, protests in support of Palestine and Palestinians in general. And German authorities have clamped down on this in an incredible way, arresting protesters, you know, shutting down protests. There's these Jewish commissioners that each federal state in Germany has, and these commissioners are often not Jewish, and yet they're often criticizing even Jews who speak up in defense of the Palestinian people in Germany. And yet, you know, here are these non-Jewish kind of government officials criticizing Jews for defending Palestine. And so that is something that, you know, there was a really interesting, you know, opinion piece a couple of weeks ago in the New York Times that kind of gets at this and how Berlin is not the same city it used to be ever since October 7th, because of, you know, what Berlin, a city that used to be thought of as a very kind of liberal, open city, the city of artists, of free expression, of radical politics, and all of that is ceasing to be. And that's a conscious decision of the German government and German authorities. So, you know, there's also an interesting case in which, listeners may be aware about the ICJ, the International Court of Justice case that's moving forward against Israel. Well, actually, Nicaragua brought a case against Germany for supporting Israel, arguing that Germany may be responsible for supporting acts of genocide. And so, we have yet to see if that case is going to move ahead in a similar way, but it's also something interesting to watch. So, you know, in Germany, which is sort of, defense of Israel and the state of Israel is kind of baked into the German government and ideology, and has been for some time, ever since, you know, the Holocaust. You know, reparations have been made to Holocaust victims. Israel, you know, Germany has just always been Israel as a state's biggest supporter. And so that now is running into all of this opposition in Germany. And there's this huge kind of clash that's going on there as we speak.
Yeah, and actually Namibia brought a case against Germany too. We actually talked with someone in Namibia about that, a couple months ago or so, which was also very interesting, because Namibia was under German colonialism, and what Germany did in Namibia was considered the first genocide of the 20th century. So it's all very interesting. Right-wing ideology is strengthening and expanding to many countries. Of course, we have Trump here, and Trump is kind of looms to a large degree over that beyond the United States. What are your thoughts about that? We have only like 2 minutes left, but can we do anything? What can we do? What should we keep our eyes open for? It's a very scary trend to me.
Yeah, absolutely. I would say the one thing that voters can do is urge their legislators to support legislation on domestic extremism, because basically what happens is a president, Democratic presidents in recent years have introduced, new programs to monitor extremists, including far-right extremists, but without sort of a congressional allocation or authority for, legislation that's going to make this more long-term. Other presidents, like, Trump has kind of repealed those same same program. So I think it's really a political decision that of whether U.S. authorities are going to be given the tools and pushed to monitor far-right extremism to the extent that they monitor potential Islamic extremism as well.
Yeah, and Jacob, you will be coming to town and also to Milwaukee to talk about the book Tuesday, May 14 at 6 p.m. here at A Room of One's Own, and Thursday, May 16 at 6:30 in Milwaukee at Boswell Books. I know that we have listeners here from Milwaukee. Anything you want to say about that in a half a minute?
Yeah, thanks so much. I'm really excited for both of these book talks. I had the pleasure of, you read that in my bio that I teach at universities. I was in Madison for last fall. I was teaching international reporting and migration. So I was back for 4 months and I really enjoyed that. Made some connections there. Went to a wonderful book talk by an international studies professor at Room of One's Own. And now, fortunately, Room of One's Own has invited me back. It's going to be an event sponsored by Voces de la Frontera, immigrants' rights groups, who your listeners may be familiar with. So please, May 14th, come to that talk at Room of One's Own if you're in the Madison area. And then again, Voces de la Frontera is also sponsoring the Milwaukee talk at Boswell Books on May 16th. So thank you so much. Yeah.
Yes. Well, Jacob Kushner is, foreign correspondent, author. We were talking about his new book titled Look Away, A True Story of Murders, Bombings, and a Far-Right Campaign to Rid Germany of Immigrants. Thank you so much, Jacob, for joining us from Nairobi.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And thank you to our team here, of course, Jade and Summer and... I'm doing very badly here. but anyway, I'm Esti Dinur, and I will be talking to you next week. Bye-bye.
You're listening to WORT Madison.
Wow! I feel good. I knew that I wouldn't. I feel good. I knew that I wouldn't. So good. So good. I got you. Wow! I feel nice. A sugar and spice. I feel nice. A sugar and spice. So nice, so nice. I got you.
Well, good afternoon. Welcome to the Mel and Floyd Summer Replacement Show. I'm Mel. Floyd is on assignment, but with us, as always, the man who knows everything, Mr. Smarty Pants.
Oh, are we doing the show?
Yeah, we're gonna do it one more time here.
I'm almost done with this crossword puzzle, Mel. I don't know if I can interrupt myself enough to do that. Gotta have my priorities straight here.
We could come back later.
Yeah, that's fine. You just do it, and I'll get back to you later.
Just play some.
So here was the one I thought many superheroes have them.
Capes.
Yeah, I thought capes, but it's many, many letters. And I thought, secret identities, but that doesn't fit. It's origin story.